For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We are live today, earlier than usual, due to special memorial coverage after this program on the passing of Congressman John Lewis. Also, we just learned that NPR's coverage is now beginning earlier than originally planned, so Maine Calling today will just be from now till 1 p.m. Fortunately, Secretary Matt Dunlap is on the line. Flexible. Thank you, Matt. And we're going to talk about this month's primary, what's in store for the November election, and more. As always, we want to hear from you. And please be quick. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. Matt, nice to hear your voice. Thank you for being with us for this shortened Maine Calling.
Well, Jennifer, let me just say right out of the gate that it's a privilege and an honor to take a back seat to the memorial service for Congressman John Lewis. He's a towering figure in the world of civil rights.
Yeah, and so I want to talk to you really quickly about the primary election earlier this month, an unprecedented number for a non-presidential election for absentee ballots, I understand. How did everything go?
It seemed to go really smoothly. You know, all those months of planning seemed to pay off. Our turnout by absentee was probably close to 80%. We had about 199,000 absentee ballots that were issued prior to the deadline on July 14th. And we still had in-person voting available, but we think that probably turnout overall, we're still getting the final numbers together, but somewhere between 27 and 30%, which is about almost double what you expect for a primary election. And it seems to have been conducted safely. All the CDC guidelines that we implemented, we've been watching the numbers from the CDC every day very carefully, and it does not look like anybody risked any increased risk of infection by voting. So that's really, really good news, especially as we get into planning for November.
Talk to me about the ranked choice voting. I know in the second congressional district, the race did go to an RCV count. How did that go?
It went very smoothly, and we've gotten a little bit of practice at it now, so it went a little bit quicker than we had anticipated. Of course, you know, right out of the gate, the first question we got the next day was, are we going to do the ranked choice tabulation, because both Adrian Bennett and Eric Brakey had conceded? Well, the law doesn't speak to that. The law says you have to have a complete tabulation of the vote. And it also says that if nobody in a three-way race gets 50% plus one, a clear majority, that you have to go to the rankings. So we went to the rankings. It took a day or two to get all the materials together. We had everything loaded in by late Monday afternoon, early Tuesday morning, and then we ran the tabulation on Tuesday. And it was sort of anticlimactic. Nothing changed. We had six ranked choice tabulations, and all the first round leaders wound up coming out on top in those rankings.
All right. Tell us about November. Will there be ranked choice voting in November? Do we not know that yet? I understand that there's a lawsuit now.
Well, there's a lot of players on this stage, so it's easy to get confused. So we will not be using ranked choice voting in the races for the legislature. However, we will use it for the federal races. There has been ongoing litigation around use of ranked choice voting ever since it was adopted by the voters. A new lawsuit was filed last week to try to stop the use of ranked choice voting altogether. Presuming that does not have an impact on how we conduct our election in November, then we would be using ranked choice voting in the races for Congress, U.S. Senate, and President.
All right. And so that's what people can expect come November. What do you expect in terms of absentee voting in November, Secretary?
We anticipate it to be extremely heavy, certainly matching the numbers by percentage that we saw in the July primary. But, you know, if you're looking at a turnout in a presidential election, which usually goes somewhere around 70% or higher, then we could anticipate having as many as 600,000 absentee ballots for the November election. And to put that in perspective, I mentioned that we had close to 200,000 for the primary. In the 2018 cycle, an open race for governor, two contested primaries for the Republicans and Democrats, and we issued about 35,000 absentee ballots. So absentee balloting is going to be a critical factor in the November election.
What does that mean for staff, for town election officials, and for your office?
It's quite a strain for town officials, and there's absolutely no doubt about that. There's a lot of paperwork that goes around absentee balloting, and this is one of the things that was called upon during the planning, is that maybe we should do something similar to what Oregon and Washington State do, which is a true all-mail election. But, you know, and that the difference, it sounds like a distinction without a difference, but absentee balloting is got a lot of paperwork to it that mail-in voting does not. And in mail-in voting, the elections officials actually initiate the contact, and they send out absentee ballots to registered voters who have confirmed their addresses. And we don't really have that mechanism. So our law says people have to ask for the ballot. It's very easy to do. And then we have an application process, and that application and the envelope that the ballot's returned to is kept together for some period of time after the election when the ballots are cast. So the ballots are cast secretly, but we keep all the materials. So a lot of paperwork. It's an awful lot for the towns to manage. But I have to say they did a really, really good job for the July primary, which is, like I say, good news for the November election.
Is there any financial help coming from either the federal government or another source to help towns and help your office with the November election?
Well, in the initial CARES Act stimulus package, they did put $400 million into the conduct of elections. Maine qualifies for about $3.2 million of that. And that's the pool of money that we've drawn on to get personal protective equipment for all poll workers in the primary. We provided pens for every voter. So in some towns, collected the pens to be used again in November, but we also didn't discourage people from taking the pens with them rather than have somebody sanitizing pens all day. So, you know, the thought process around minimizing what people touch is sort of how we directed our CARES Act funding, and that's where, you know, the increase in printed ballots for the absentee process came into play, the personal protective equipment. Now we're talking about, you know, what other things we could do for the November election. Nothing really is finalized. We're taking some lessons learned from the primary. We're going to meet with some town clerks in the governor's office and try to solidify a plan well in advance of the election, and then we'll hopefully be able to help the towns out. We did provide 80% matching funds for towns that got drop boxes, the same type of drop boxes that are used in all mail states, and a number of towns purchased those, and we've helped them defray those costs. We'll be able to do that as long as the money lasts, but once the money's gone, we'll have to be very careful with going forward with what little resources we have left.
We're talking with Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap. We're talking elections. We'll also be talking about the U.S. Census and the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. If you'd like to join the conversation, this is an abbreviated version of our program. So if you'd like to join the conversation, please call now, 1-800-399-3566, or send a very brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Matt, your office is facing a lawsuit over absentee voting for visually impaired voters. I understand there's either got to be an answer or a plan by August 10th. The U.S. District Judge has ordered that. Where are you in coming up with a solution?
Well, actually, we have some exciting things that we're working on that we're hopeful to do anyway. The litigation is completely apart from that. And litigation is something that informs this process. And so, you know, we don't ever shy away from litigation. And I can't speak to that lawsuit. But we do have some technologies that we can employ and modify that we can make it easier for make it easy at all for people with disabilities to access absentee ballots privately. And that's probably all I should say about it because there is litigation, but you know, we think we can do something to help folks and probably obviate the need for further litigation on it.
All right, well, let's talk about the U.S. Census. Several states, including Maine, apparently not doing well with the percentage of residents responding to the survey. What's happening now? Difficult to deploy people to homes in the midst of COVID.
Well, the census has actually begun deploying canvassers in those areas that are sometimes hard to reach, the very rural areas where people may have less connectivity to online services. And, even mail can be very difficult. So the time-honored way of doing a census is sending out somebody with a clipboard, going door-to-door and asking people how many people live here. And so that's what they're doing now. They've only just started that. Obviously, everything is behind schedule because this part was supposed to be happening in April, and here we are now near the end of July, and it's kind of just gotten its wheels off the ground. But we're pretty confident that we'll have a very strong count by the end. But again, people who want to participate in this census, and they should, because all those, you know, billions of dollars, even in the CARES Act money, but the normal routine of funding, including education funding, transportation funding, infrastructure funding that is allocated by the federal government, is largely done by population. So you can get online, you know, go to the library if you don't have a computer, and you can type in, you know, the 2020 census, and it'll take you right to the census page, and you can get right in and participate. I did it without having ever visited the website before. I got my share of the census done in about 5 minutes. My daughter hadn't even done as much as I had, and she did hers in less than 5 minutes. So it's a pretty simple process.
All right. How do you think the data will be affected by the fact that people are living, kind of many people living where they might not be living? Young adults, for example, living with their parents to ride out the COVID. On the other hand, college students that left Maine early to do online classes in the spring.
Well, you know, the whole census numbers are sort of a snapshot of April 1st. And, you know, when my daughter had to do hers, my presumption was that she would be counted in our household. But it's actually where she had planned to spend the most part of the year, which is at the University of Maine. So she had to do hers separately. And none of that has changed with the census. So people who have questions ought to get on the website and ask those questions rather than not participate. Make sure that you get counted however accurately it can be done, and just do that quick determination about where you should be counted. So that's pretty easy to do. They make it user-friendly, and I would encourage people to get on the website and check it out.
All right. And quickly, before we go to audience questions, want to ask you a Bureau of Motor Vehicles question. I understand driver's tests are happening again. Last time you were on the program, BMV was prioritizing commercial tests. Are we doing now non-commercial tests? Are 16-year-olds lining up?
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, we had quite a few that were sort of left stranded after we shut down the office in the middle of March. And we've been testing all those folks and then scheduling some of the new ones. The driver ed schools are back open again, and we're starting to see that traffic, you know, tick up a little bit. It's probably going to be a while before we get everything caught up. We're trying to obviously work on the backlogs at the same time as we're trying to schedule some new young drivers for their tests and some, you know, other tests like medical exams and that sort of thing. We are caught up with the commercial vehicle testing now, so that's good news. But you know, it'll probably be close to the end of the year before we get off to our level traffic patterns again. And also, it's an important thing that people should know is that, you know, we're not just going to, you know, wipe our brow and say, boy, we got through that. We are already planning for the potential of another surge and how we do our business continuity in the face of that. In the middle of March, we didn't know what we were contending with, and it was pretty scary, and we just closed the offices. I think we wanted to be a little bit more proactive going forward as we get a better understanding of the coronavirus and understand what we can continue to do should there be another surge of the virus infection rate.
All right. Well, we're going to start with a question from our own Mal Leary. Can you please ask Secretary Dunlap about Tiffany Bond? She insists she's a candidate for Senate, but she is not on his list of candidates that have filed the necessary petitions.
Well, she has some legal remedies yet before her, but her petition for a preliminary injunction was rejected last week. She only got, I think, about fewer than 700 signatures. And her contention was that because of the coronavirus, it made it impossible for her to collect signatures on nominating petitions. And for the listeners, you know, someone who wants to run as an independent candidate typically has until June 1st, and they have to get twice as many signatures as a party candidate. However, the party candidates have to get theirs in by March 15th, and they can only get signatures from members of their party. Independents can get signatures from any registered voter, but they have to get 4,000 signatures. So it's a lot of signatures they have to get. We pushed out the deadline to July 1st, and Bond only got, like I say, fewer than 700. But the court did not countenance her arguments for the preliminary injunction. And actually, Max Lynn, before he dropped out, managed to get plenty of signatures to qualify, which sort of begs the question as to whether or not it was really feasible to put that argument forth. So right now she's not a candidate. Like I say, she does have further legal avenues available to her, but that's where it is right now at this hour.
All right. And in November, will the CMP corridor question be on the ballot as a referendum question?
Well, that's right now they've qualified for the ballot. There's a lot of discussion about the nature of the resolve that's being put before the voters and whether or not it is properly before the voters and is enforceable. But, the Supreme Court is now contemplating that as to whether or not the question should go forward. So we don't really know how that's going to turn out just yet.
All right. We'll go to Arlene, who's calling from Gardner. Hi, Arlene. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. My question is for Secretary Matthew Dunlap. This year for the primary was the first time in 50 years that I used the absentee ballot. And I got it in the mail, and I looked it over, filled it out, and I sent it back. I could not find where to sign. So then some weeks went by, and then I got a call from your office saying my ballot had been declined or whatever, and to contact the city hall, town hall in Gardner, somebody named Kelly. I did so, and when I talked to her, she said, I don't know. She checked on it, and I could not vote again. And so, because I thought maybe I'll just go to the polls. And so the day of voting, I got a call from the Democratic something or other telling me, asking me if I had voted, and I told her the story. And she said, oh, yes, you can go vote. And I said, who told you that? I said, well, who it was, and at the town hall. And so I showed up at the town hall and I at the school where I voted. I got through just fine. My name was there as on the list as voters. I voted and whatever. So I just want to know, did I vote twice or how to make it more clear?
Okay, go. Yeah, I'm going to let Matt go because we have so many calls coming in so little time. Go ahead, Matt.
So the answer is, Arlene, is no, you did not vote twice. You only voted once. And the legal, there's nowhere to sign on the ballot. You'd have to sign the back of the envelope. And if you did not sign the back of the envelope, then yes, the ballot would be rejected because there's no way to connect the actual ballot to you. So yes, you were perfectly fine to show up at the polls and make sure that you got a vote, got a ballot, and were able to vote it. So the information you got was correct. This is something that happens periodically, especially for people who don't vote by absentee very often. It's a pretty simple process, but you do have to follow all those steps. So if you didn't sign the envelope, it's easier just to show up at the polls and vote. So you did the right thing.
All right, Arlene, thanks for your question. So many more about the absentee ballots. This one is an email from Mary. I had to put 70 cents postage on the ballot I mailed in for the July primary. It seems this could be a big barrier to mail-in voting that will be necessary in November. My siblings in other states do not need to use postage. Is this our town? I live in Cape Elizabeth that required the postage. Is this a state requirement? I am very concerned this will keep many from being able to safely vote.
Well, the Postal Service will always deliver election mail, always deliver ballots, regardless of whether or not you have sufficient postage on it. But postal rules stipulate that the clerk does have to indicate how much postage is required. And if you go to a post office window, they're going to tell you it needs 70 cents. And the expectation is you're going to put 70 cents worth of postage on that return envelope. A lot of times some towns forget to write that in, and somebody will put 150-cent stamp on it. Don't worry. The post office will deliver it. In that case, the town is responsible for the postage. This is another suggestion that we've got, is that we use some CARES Act money to help pay for postage. And that's something we've heard a lot about, and I think we're going to talk about that some more going forward, depending on the resources we have. So that's the story on postage. It's not a barrier for people to get their ballots in.
All right. We'll go to Maureen calling from Lubeck. Hi, Maureen. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Secretary, what are the provisions are being made for extra voting machines to be available in rural areas should voting machines go down? I was in Machias for the primary. The voting machine was broken, reported broken before the polls even opened. And we got a check-in, but we didn't get that machine fixed, or if you want to call it that, until after 5 p.m. That's a whole day of almost of voting.
Well, if people who show up in a community that has a tabulator and the tabulator does go down for some reason, they can still turn in their ballots. We actually have a side bin that is secure on those machines, and people can deposit their ballots. Some communities still have their old wooden ballot boxes, and the clerks will put those out, especially for the hand count towns that don't use machines at all. So there's still a provision for people to turn their ballots in and cast them. In terms of the tabulator, all the tabulator does is record the numbers at the end of the day. So if the technician didn't get there till after 5 o'clock and get the machine fixed, you can be assured that all those ballots were run through and were properly counted. We distribute tabulators based sort of loosely on population. So small towns with usually fewer than a few hundred voters probably don't get a tabulator because they can hand count those ballots pretty quickly in a matter of maybe an hour or so, and the tabulators are pretty expensive. So we ideally we'd have them in every town, but we just don't have the money to do it.
All right. Thanks for your call, Maureen. Chris sends an email. In our town, there have already been lots of issues with political signs. Can the secretary please share what the fines are for taking or damaging political signs, what the guidelines are for where they can go, and if homemade signs are allowed?
Okay, I'll take those sort of in order. First of all, we don't have jurisdiction over signs. DOT is very frustrated to have to deal with that. But signs, the rule on signs, yes, homemade signs are fine. Typically, if you have a candidate who's putting out signs, they have a disclaimer on the sign as to who paid for it, you know, paid for by the candidate or by the whatever committee. And rights of way, which is typically defined, a right of way is defined from a certain number of feet from the center line of a road. We usually define it loosely as 3 feet off the pavement. You know, signs can only be up for a certain period of time before the election, and then they have to be down within a couple of days of the election. On people's lawns, those restrictions don't apply. So people can put up a sign for a candidate on their lawn at any time and leave it there for years, and that's perfectly permissible. So people who have complaints about signs, typically that's enforceable by local law enforcement authorities. So the local police, they get a lot of complaints about people putting signs in, like, medians and triangles where it's hard for people to see oncoming traffic because of signs. And that's the most typical complaint about campaign signs around election seasons.
All right, we have an email from Naomi. This past primary, my partner and I both received absentee ballots, but the return envelope sealed shut before we had a chance to vote. We were able to swap them out at the town office. I wonder how many others had this issue. Maybe it won't be a concern in a winter election, but something to consider in the future. Matt, is this the first time you've heard about sticky envelopes sealing themselves?
And this is the first time I've heard about sticky envelopes sealing themselves, and it's hard to say. I mean, you know, it's been a very humid summer, and depending on, you know, where the envelopes were stored, sometime in transit, it might have been really damp, and that does happen. So, but I'm glad it worked out for them.
All right, we'll go to Bernie, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Bernie. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I have some questions about problems I noticed in the primary absentee ballot process. I'm wondering whether those will be the same in November. The problem, there was a complete absence of any drop-off boxes. It was mail or nothing. Well, there was a possibility of dropping your ballot.
Sure.
At the hall.
Sure, Bernie. Yeah, Matt, you talked about this already, right? There were some this past election. You're hoping for more in November. Are you hoping that this will be statewide in November?
Well, I mean, this was the first time we'd even contemplated the use of drop boxes, and the availability was a bit limited, and only a few towns actually went out and got them. We suspect we'll see a lot more of them for the November election.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Bernie. Going here to Michael on Facebook, Republicans seem to be still demonizing ranked choice voting and claiming it unfairly favors Democrats. Does RCV favor one party or another? If not, what is the force driving the reluctance to adopt RCV?
It does not have any partisan weight to it whatsoever. That was never the intent. I think it became partisan after the real drive to push ranked choice voting came after the re-election of Governor LePage in a multi-candidate race, and you know he got less than 50% of the vote. And then that's when the next cycle is when you saw the referendum. And I think the Republicans began to see this as an assault on the LePage administration. But we've been talking about some form of runoff voting for over 20 years before that. So it became partisan, but that's never how it started out, and it doesn't have a partisan implication either.
All right. An email from Jim. For the November election, what's the basic outline to encourage and support voting absentee? Do you have any concerns about the mail delays reported in the Portland, Maine post office?
Well, I think we're going to employ the same strategy that we did for the primary in terms of encouraging absentee balloting. I think it's safe to say, Jennifer, that with the pandemic still raging around the world, that we're probably nowhere near out of the woods just yet. So I'll probably see something to a similar program that we did in July for the primary in November, which means we'll probably be strongly encouraging absentee balloting. In terms of the Postal Service, this is something that we felt the weight of going into the July primary, because the Postal Service is suffering from the same strains as the rest of us. You know, they don't have enough staff, they don't have enough facilities, and, you know, they're coping as best they can. So this is something that we're talking about. We talked about it in July, like, don't wait till the day before the election to mail in your absentee ballot, because it has to be in the possession of the clerk under Maine law by 8 p.m. on election night. So if it shows up the next day, then it can't be counted. So, you know, that's something that we've been talking about straight down the line. I think we'll continue to encourage people to participate this way. And if they think they don't have enough time to get it in the mail, we were telling people in July, allow for a week to 10 days to get things mailed back, just to make sure that everybody has it.
I'm going to apologize to everyone who was not able to get their question into this shortened Maine calling. But, Matt, I'm going to wrap by asking if you'll come back.
Absolutely.
Anytime. Okay, great. So next time you can ask Secretary Dunlap your question. Matthew Dunlap, Maine Secretary of State, serving his final term in that position. Coming up next is special NPR memorial coverage of the late Congressman John Lewis. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.